It's time for your weekly fix of wrestling nostalgia when we look at wrestling's past eras from the Attitude Era to the Reality Era.
I'd like to think that maybe this company will be better after Vince McMahon's dead, but the fact is, it's going to get taken over by his idiotic daughter and his doofus son-in-law and the rest of his stupid family.
To today. Here on the WWE Podcast.
Welcome to the WWE Podcast, everybody. It's time for a little wrestling nostalgia. It's time to take you into the vault that is Albany, New York. And open that vault in the arena that we have in downtown Albany, which was originally known as the Knickerbocker Arena, then became the Pepsi Arena, now is the Times Union Center. So you may not think that there's a lot of history here in Albany. When you think of history in WWE, big moments, Albany, New York is not exactly a city that springs to mind. But Zach Perez and I are here today to hopefully change that opinion or give you a little bit of an education on some of the huge moments that have happened here in Albany. And actually, we are the home of the biggest single Raw moment in the history of Raw. How about that? That is true. And you probably all know what that is, and you're thinking, oh, that was there? Yes, it was. Yes, it was. Toot, toot, my own horns. But, guys, thank you so much for joining me on this Sunday, November 17th, 2019. And so we got a great show coming up for you with Zach Perez, which he hosts the AEW Aftershock on Thursdays. And great host, great co-host, and it's a great great conversation that we had about the moments in time that happened at Albany, New York. So you're going to not want to miss that. And as always, you can head up on Twitter, hit me up, and at the WWE Podcast if you'd like to talk about wrestling. And you can also head on over to patreon.com/WWE Podcast if you want an ad-free experience of this show and get a shout-out, come on the show, do your own show, video shout-outs, lots of other cool stuff. Head on over to patreon.com/WWE Podcast. So I'm going to cut everything short. I'm going to get right to the point. I'm not going to let you guys wait. Let's get right to the conversation with Zach and myself. And again, as a reminder, I'll be back Tuesday with a Raw review. Wednesday, I'll be back with some more nostalgia. And then Thursday and Friday are your AEW NXT. Saturday is a full Survivor Series preview. Loaded week coming up. Hope you guys stick with us here and subscribe to this podcast. I really would appreciate it. And everybody, enjoy your night, evening, morning, whatever you're listening, and enjoy this conversation. I'll talk to you next time. All right, welcome back to the show. And of course, it's Sunday, which means a special show, which means today I have Zach Perez on here, who is going to cover some nostalgia, some very localized nostalgia. You may know Zach, of course, as your AEW Aftershock host here on the WWE Podcast Network. And Zach, welcome to the show. It's great to connect with you, and I've been loving the shows. I know that the people listening to your shows love your AEW reviews, and now we get to do a little bit of a nostalgic show ourselves.
Thank you. Yeah, it's really been a lot of fun so far. I really appreciate all the fans who've been listening and supporting the show. And it's really cool to kind of connect and connect back to really the way that we got started talking about wrestling and talking and getting started with the show and talking about, you know, right where the home of wrestling is in Albany. So it's a pretty full circle experience on a Sunday night, right?
It really is. And I don't think I've ever spoken locally, anyway, in a large capacity for an entire podcast, done a localized wrestling nostalgia show. But to be honest, as we were just saying off the air, little old Albany, New York has quite a bit of history in its in wrestling history anyway. And, you know, one of them got voted the biggest Raw moment in history. And so we're going to get to that. Obviously, there have been a few pay-per-views in Albany. And when I say a few, I literally mean a few. With, as Zach gave me the stats before the show, we have had 40 televised, or televised, is it televised and house shows or just televised total?
So we've had 40 televised shows and 3 pay-per-views total, and even more house shows dating back a few, I think, back in the early 90s before they started doing televised shows. So Albany's had, I think, 3 house shows before that and some scattered main events and things like that, but 40 televised and 3 pay-per-views. So a lot of wrestling history inside of the Knickerbocker, Pepsi, Times Union Center, whatever you want to call it.
And for those that don't know, it used to be called originally the Knickerbocker Arena, and this is located in downtown Albany. And then it became the Pepsi Arena, and then it was transformed into the Times Union Center in 2007. So it is now and currently remains the Times Union Center. It has been now for 12 years, almost going on 13. And you know, Zach brought up some good points before we went on the air and said that there has been a title change on every pay-per-view that Albany has hosted. So let's start with the 92 Rumble. And Zach, let me toss this one to you and give us some of the things that happened here in Albany, New York back in 1992.
Yeah, so one of the things, you know, I just went back and watched this again, and really, although some of the matches don't quite age so well looking back, one of the matches that really stuck out to me was watching the Orient Express take on the New Foundation. This was when the New Foundation was rocking the nice Windbreaker 90s-inspired neon pants, you know, before Anvil Neidhart ended up leaving a few weeks later, and they abandoned that whole shtick. But you could really see this was when Owen Hart was really at his best, putting a huge influence onto the future of wrestling. And it's really a shame that we lost him so young, because I think that he would have probably been influencing the next 30 years of wrestling still. I mean, it's just so crazy to see. He was doing some springboards, and you could see his influence now on Pete Dunne with the nice finger locks and stepping on the hands, and just some really beautiful wrestling by Owen Hart, and that really stuck out. Some great storytelling and ring psychology, and he really kind of carried the entire match, to be quite honest, throughout that. So really great performance by him. But next up was Roddy Piper versus the Mountie, and Roddy Piper ended up taking Intercontinental Championship gold, which was his only WWF singles title. So that was a huge moment, which was the biggest moment of the night, in my opinion. Match was a little lackluster, but really just seeing that moment happen, the promo beforehand, the energy that Roddy Piper always brings, that was just such a huge moment to see inside of, you know, Smallbony. So that was really, really cool to see. Then, you know, a couple of tag team matches leading into the main event, which was the Royal Rumble, of course, where Ric Flair ended up lasting all the way from the third spot and setting a world record at the time, as Gorilla Monsoon and Bobby Heenan would let you know throughout the night. That he went from third and ended up lasting over an hour to win the Royal Rumble. I still think it would have been kind of nice to see Roddy Piper win the dual championship, being that he almost made it to the end, but it was still a really cool night, and it was really cool to see a title change hands in both Roddy Piper getting his Intercontinental title and seeing Ric Flair win the WWE Championship for, you know, however many times by then.
And yeah, and again, I was not in attendance, and as you noted, you weren't even born for this to actually be in attendance for the show. I was a ripe old age of 7, so I obviously I did not attend, and I didn't even know wrestling existed until 97 or 96. So yeah, this was a significant pay-per-view for the WWF at the time, and headlined by Ric Flair, obviously winning the Royal Rumble, and it was. Again, I mean, I need to go back and watch this entire pay-per-view in its entirety and really absorb exactly what was going on at the time, because this is pre, obviously, Attitude Era, but only a few years before, to see what's going on and Roddy Piper and Flair and, you know, as you mentioned. I really think that this is a underrated pay-per-view in a lot of different ways. But, yeah, so, again, I wish I had more first-hand experience on this one. Unfortunately, I don't. But I do have first-hand experience with the other pay-per-views that were housed in Albany. and at the time called the Pepsi Arena. And just so the people listening know, the reason Zach called it Smallbony, if you guys don't know, is because those of you that whenever you hear somebody say, oh, I'm from New York, people immediately think, oh, New York City. And when you say, no, 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 I'm from upstate, people automatically think, oh, you mean Westchester. And they don't realize there's 90% more of the state to go. And so we're from the upstate, also known as Smallbony, from those in New York City who look at Albany as really small. So that's how Albany gets its Smallbony nickname. So those of you that didn't know, now you know. But so we get into some other pay-per-views here that are... again, more significant to me simply because of the fact that I was alive and attended these pay-per-views. We moved to the No Mercy pay-per-view in 2000, October of 2000. I think it was October 20th of 2000. I remember winning tickets at the Great Escape. You know where that is because you're a local guy. Up in Lake George, New York, I ended up winning tickets to this pay-per-view because they had a contest at the Great Escape, which was an amusement park. It's like Six Flags, kind of a mini version of Six Flags. And my brother and I had to do like perform wrestling, some anything wrestling related on this stage that was kind of in the middle of the park. And my brother and I won because I ended up giving him a Stone Cold Stunner. He could sell the hell out of it. And then doing the worm, and people, you know, loved it, and I ended up winning the tickets. So that's how I attended this pay-per-view. Wrestling is just woven throughout my teenage life, which I don't know if that's better or worse, but it happened.
That really is great that it predated the age of smartphones, I guess, isn't it, right?
Oh, my God,
that somebody
yes.
doesn't have footage out there somewhere of you doing that?
No. It is buried in people's minds, but that's where it will stay.
Exactly. No. You're just a faceless person out there. Somebody won't ever be able to connect you to it anyway,
never.
Right?
No, because I had hair back then. I do not have hair now. I lost hair. I'm only 34, but like I don't know what the hell is wrong with my genes. Everyone else in my family, except my brother and I, have hair. And like all of a sudden, we're just like, if we don't shave our heads, we're going to look like fools. So what do we do? I mean, like, so I don't know. But anyway, you guys are learning a lot more about me than you need to know. What you want to know about is this pay-per-view. And this took place, as I said, on October 20th of 2000, and there was some significant things that happened on this show, and not just from a perspective of a title change, but also the return of Stone Cold Steve Austin, who, in one of the most significant storylines in the history of the company, was run down at Survivor Series the year before, and there was a mystery assailant. It all came down to who done it. And in one of the most, I think one of the better whodunit, not, you know, this past year of, well, Eric Rowan ran down, Roman Reigns. I mean, we had a real good payoff here. And yes, it was Rikishi. And to some people, it was a bit of a letdown, but at the same time, they were trying to build a new heel. So Rikishi immediately got heat on him. And this is where Stone Cold drove his truck into the pay-per-view, ended up beating the holy hell out of Rikishi. And never delivered a stunner. I was a bit sad about that. I don't know why he never got a stunner off. I was a bit disappointed. But the match ended up in the outside the arena, where Austin was basically going to commit vehicular manslaughter on Rikishi, only to be stopped by the Albany PD. So obviously, there's more matches, and we'll get to those too. But what were some of your thoughts, Zach, and memories of the No Mercy pay-per-view?
Yeah, you know, that's the one that sticks out in my mind. I went through and I watched all the pay-per-views through again, you know, in preparation for this. And the matches leading up to this were a little bit lackluster. The card was a little bit run down a little bit leading up to this. You know, the Jericho X-Pac match a little earlier on was nice. But, you know, this match just felt so unique because you had Stone Cold returning and there was just so much. The crowd was so behind it and everything was just, the energy was so electric. And Stone Cold was feeding off of it. And I think a lot of what may have been behind him not delivering the stunner was He still had the two braces on the knees, and he still definitely looked a little labored in his movement and things like that. But, you know, it definitely was just a huge moment in pro wrestling to have him return after so long, and the anticipation behind it, and him just whooping Rikishi all over, and the blood rushing down his face, and him, you know, the moment of him chugging the beer as he drove the truck through, and him crashing into the stage as he drove it to the back into Albany, and driving out into the road. And it was just such a brilliant angle, too, to have him get arrested by the police. I just thought the execution of it all was just done so perfectly, and if there were limitations to him, they worked around it absolutely beautifully, and to get him arrested and to do all of that just made so much sense and made his character look so much more badass. And I don't quite understand how they don't get how to book baby faces like they used to, because that is how you make a badass baby face. And Stone Cold was just the best to ever do it when it comes to that role.
It was. Stone Cold, I mean, I could, again, everyone knows that he was my reason for really beginning and watching wrestling, and still to this day is one of my favorites and might be the favorite of all time for me. But yes, back then you had an emotional investment. You had an attachment, a reason to get behind this character, beyond him being brilliant on the mic, in the ring. Believability was off the charts for the character, which is such a missing key factor in almost every top babyface, and I say that loosely, in WWE today. There's just no believability, and it just feels so more robotic and manufactured. Where Austin, yes, of course, he was, you know, he knew who was going to win and lose the match, but there wasn't such a micromanagement of characters and movements and speaking, where guys could just go out and be themselves more or less and fill in the blanks and just say, here's where we want to go, get us there. And now it's, again, we all know the structure and culture of WWE, as pointed out by many podcasts like John Moxley and CM Punk and others. So, again, the match was, it wasn't really a match per se, as it was just kind of a beatdown of Rikishi, and it lasted only 9 minutes. And it ended in a no contest, which made sense. And yes, the execution of the arrest was exactly the way that it should have been done. It was believable. You know, the police were there and should have arrested Austin based on the fact that, hey, yeah, this is wrestling, but you're going too far. You're about to, you know, kill a man. We need to arrest you for public safety. I mean, it just made sense, and it didn't feel forced or contrived. It felt believable and understandable that the police needed to be there for it. That was a huge thing I remember. And the other matches in the card, so without, you know, missing that, the Dudley Boys were facing the Right to Censor, and it was a Dudley's Invitational Tables match that lasted 12 minutes. And I don't remember too much about that match per se. Again, the big thing was Austin in a match that I'll get to, which was the final match of Kurt Angle and The Rock. The APA and Lita versus TNA and Trish ended up in a no contest. Chris Jericho defeated X-Pac by escaping the cage. I do remember that vaguely. Right to Censor defeated Billy Gunn and China. Oh boy, Right to Censor. Oh man, that was a group. Quickly, let me ask you on that. What do you remember about Right to Censor? Did you love that group? Did you hate their group and their music? Did you find it really ear piercing and just go away heat, or do you think that this was a underrated faction that could have had a longer run?
I think that the theme had go-away heat, but I think that the faction itself actually had some solid thought process behind it, especially given the time of wrestling, you know, given that it was the Attitude Era and there was so much going on. I think that they really could have made some sense out of it. I think that it was a little bit thrown together. Father, for example, probably didn't need to be in that group. But, you know, I think they could have been better. They could have probably had some longevity, but it was just something that was kind of such a thrown together project that I think it was always kind of destined for the bin. I think Stevie Richards always was an underutilized talent, and unfortunately he never was going to capture the greatness that he was when he was Nova, and that just kind of is very unfortunate given the great shape that he got in. And he really was a fantastic talent and very underutilized, and he sold this gimmick really well. well on the mic too, which it, you know, was kind of difficult given what he was given.
He did. And maybe that's what I remember most is, yes, the music was, and it was designed to be ear-piercingly annoying, go away heat. But Stevie Richards was the mastermind. He was the ringleader. He was the top dog in that group. And seeing him get beat up was always a blast. Yes, Godfather joined in. Bill Buchanan joined in. Ivory joined in. I think that they had heat. And really, as you said, it was thrown together, but I think as a response of WWE mocking those who would like to have censored or think WWE should be censored. And I think it was just a direct response to that. And so anyway, moving along here, William Regal defeated Naked Midian. God almighty. Los Conquistadors defeated the Hardy Boys for the WWF Tag Team Championship. Triple H defeated Chris Benoit in an 18-minute match. Vaguely remember that as well, but again, the second biggest thing here was Kurt Angle defeating The Rock in a no disqualification match for the WWF Championship. Kurt Angle winning his very first WWF Championship ever, and it occurred here in Albany, New York. What are your memories of that?
It was just such a crazy moment. You know, I do wish that it wasn't muddled a little bit by the Stephanie McMahon involvement and the overuse that they had going on in 2000 with her involvement leading into SummerSlam and, you know, the awesome SummerSlam 2000 card, which, you know, sticks out in my mind as maybe one of my favorite pay-per-views in of WWF history. But, you know, all in all, just a crazy moment and a career-defining moment for Angle, and just really set off what was a great chemistry that he had with The Rock. And the Angle earlier in the night with him having the interview where he edited clips together of The Rock and made him say what he wanted to, it was just brilliant stuff. And it really goes to show there's a lot of Kurt Angle that goes undervalued, and he was just such a great all-around worker and really one of the best of all time, and just was really the best at what he did in the ring, and just really got undervalued as a result for all the things that he did on the entertainment side as well, and was right alongside The Rock at entertaining people just in the same way. So I think that this was a great time to put the belt on him, and this match really had a lot of drama leading up to the finish, and it just was kind of overbooked at the end with Triple H coming out towards the finish and hitting a pedigree and, you know, The Rock still kicking out, and it was just a crazy overbooked ending, but it was a great time and a great time to pull the trigger and Kurt Angle the belt, and it was awesome that it happened in Albany.
Yes, it was, and being such a big Rock fan at the time, I mean, I was 15 years old, I think it was a bit disappointing for me seeing Kurt Angle win, but understanding that it was such a significant moment. I think the only saving grace for myself in my 15-year-old brain, not saying much here, but was seeing The Rock give Stephanie a rock bottom for the very first time. I believe that was the very first time that it happened. And I went nuts. The crowd went nuts just seeing that, because Stephanie was such a heat magnet and she was such a you-know-what that people would lose their minds today because, oh, that's male-on-female violence. What are you promoting? But it was such a warranted thing for The Rock to do. And, you know, it was just a rock bottom for what I remember. And it wasn't anything that was brutal, but the crowd loved it. So that was the only redeeming part of this match, at least, again, from my 15-year-old brain, understanding that the things now are much different. But so that was another thing that I do remember and absolutely loved.
Yeah, and it at the time for me was rough because I was a huge Rock fan. Like I said, you know, The Rock is still my number one of all time, and it was just such an entertaining contest. And even then, I was a fan of Kurt Angle in terms of his in-ring ability and being a fan of the just of the sport. You know, just watching it and just understanding, you know, what they do and everything like that, and just understanding the entertainment side of it and being so young and just being able to appreciate the fact that, you know, he makes me laugh when he's on and things like that. So I didn't quite understand the fact that The Rock losing meant that, you know, what it did. So that was very disappointing for me at the time to see The Rock lose. But looking back at it and looking at the career that Kurt Angle was able to have and the timing of it all, it makes a lot of sense. But it definitely was a very rough time for me as a fan of The Rock to see him losing it to Angle, especially all the heat that they were trying to promote him with. And so it was a very dividing time, especially for me and my dad as wrestling fans watching it in the kind of aftermath. Because we would usually kind of watch the Fallout episode, especially after they would come to Albany with the pay-per-view. So that was definitely a shocking night of probably Raw the night afterwards, you know?
It was. And it was just, it was a pay-per-view that, you know, being live there in the arena, being involved in a pay-per-view for the very first time was something that, especially being there for free, you know, and you all know how I got there for free, which I'd rather not repeat again, but they just that experience being there, and I was with my brother, who, again, he didn't really care about wrestling, never did. He was just kind of like only involved when the big names are there. And a lot of my friends are the same way, where they're just only interested in where's Undertaker, where's Austin, where's Rock. They only, like, anytime those people are there, they'll pay attention, but, you know, they don't have the patience for these up and coming stars or really an appreciation for the art that is wrestling. So being there with a non-wrestling fan is a little bit difficult, but it made it easier given the fact that it's 2000. And in 2000, WWE had a stacked roster, and they were at the top of their game. So I think that was a positive. But yeah, this pay-per-view overall was remembered for two things. It was remembered for Austin beating the hell out of Rikishi and driving his truck into the arena, and obviously Kurt Angle winning his WWF championship for the very first time. So another pay-per-view, and the last pay-per-view to ever occur in Albany, hopefully not ever, was the New Year's Revolution 2006. And before I go any further, Zach, were you in attendance for this, or were you not?
I was not, unfortunately. I do vividly remember trying to get tickets for this. Do remember I was a big, big John Cena fan at the time. You know, I was a huge John Cena mark, had the chain, had the lock, everything. So I remember definitely trying to get tickets, trying to convince, but I didn't end up making it to this one. And probably for the better because of the ending. Yeah, so probably would have crushed my little soul at the time. So probably for the best that I didn't make it to this one.
And if you remember, not only did John Cena, obviously this is the biggest point that came out of the whole pay-per-view with John Cena losing here, even though he won the match, Edge cashed in, is that Albany was brutal to John Cena. I mean, if you listen to the crowd reaction to John Cena in this match, it's pretty bad. I mean, the Albany audience, who at the time in 2006, you're coming off the Attitude Era, you're getting close to the PG era, but it's still a bit of a brutal time in WWE. They're in transition. John Cena is clearly the next anointed guy, and the fans in attendance were of the older variety, not a lot of families, so you get that ardent, hardcore, hangover Attitude Era fan base of 18 to 34 year old males, and you get a reaction the way that you did for John Cena. And I gotta say, I was one of the ones booing him. I really, and again, it's nothing that of a disrespect to John Cena, and I still kind of feel this way now, you know, how many years later, 13 years later, that I never disliked John Cena, just like I never disliked Roman Reigns as a character. I just think that they were both miscast, where especially you come off Austin, you come off Rock, these ardent, hardcore, true to the bone, you know, badass characters that are completely believable to this John Cena, you know, feel good, sit by the fire, kind of kumbaya, you know, pump out of the WWE machine character that the fans weren't ready to move on from Austin and Rock yet. And so John Cena got a bit of that backlash. And after John Cena won, man, I remember the crowd, like, not happy. And if you go back and listen to it, I'm sure that that'll reflect that. But having Vince McMahon come out for the very first, I believe this was, and correct me if I'm wrong, was this the very first Money in the Bank cash-in?
Off the top of my head, I want to say that it was, because I think Edge was the first one to get it. So I think that this was the first cash-in, and he was the first one to win off of it at the very least.
Okay. Yeah, I think, yeah, because I remember seeing Vince McMahon and I'm thinking, why is Vince McMahon out here? But especially watching it back, given why does Vince have to be the one to announce that they're going to cash it in? It's just kind of silly now, but Vince wanted to come out and be the figurehead of that moment, and it is what it is. And when the fans heard Edge's music, they lost their minds. And I believe Edge carried that briefcase around for months and months and months. It almost became a part of him. I remember him carrying it around so much. So I believe he carried it around for several months. So having him cash in at that moment and spear John Cena kicks out, and you're thinking, oh my God, John Cena is going to somehow pull this off. And then Edge hits a second spear, and the crowd acted like it was the bottom of the ninth and the home team hit a home run, walk-off home run. I mean, I was cheering, even though Edge was booked as a heel. He was with Lita, and he was supposed to be booed for this moment, you know, being the smarmy heel that takes advantage of a babyface that just went through hell and is obviously at a huge disadvantage. It was just almost as if anybody but John Cena, just as we've heard before, anybody but Roman, it was kind of that same dynamic with John Cena. So to see Edge beat John Cena here, it certainly made the Albany crowd happy, but I would imagine that we were the minority in the overall audience that was watching at that time.
Yeah, it was a very unique situation. Because I think a lot of people were very divided at the time with John Cena. It was a very unique point in his career because he was being booked as the top babyface. And, you know, I was looking back at his career, and I think that, you know, if probably half or so of his title reigns would have been swapped with United States or Intercontinental title runs, I think a lot of people could have stomached him a lot better, you know, if they would have just swapped them with different people at different times and things like that. But I think people just got so sick of him always being big match John and always winning the big title. And so, or a big title match rather. So this moment especially was a culture shock. It was kind of the antithesis of that. So having that happen here in Albany and everything, it's just such a crazy moment and so much of that. And it was such a shock in the Money in the Bank, played into that so perfectly. And what was kind of interesting was there was a lot of foreshadowing and a lot of kind of a full circle moment, because earlier in the night, Edge had his match with Ric Flair, and he ended up beating him down with the briefcase, and he got disqualified in that match, and he was challenging for the Intercontinental Championship. And like I said earlier, you know, Roddy Piper was the one who was the first one to win a WWF title in Times Union Center, or, you know, Knickerbocker Arena at the time then, when he won the Intercontinental Championship back at the 92 Royal Rumble. So he ended up beating Ric Flair up with the briefcase, then bloodied him up. And then later on, Ric Flair in the 92 Royal Rumble won the WWE Championship. Edge later on in the night with that briefcase cashes in and wins the WWE Championship. So it's kind of this weird full circle. He joins the names who have won titles in the building. It was this kind of strange foreshadowing moment that kind of really all fits and worked very well. So it's pretty crazy that everything kind of all fell together and all happened at John Cena's expense. But I think that the crowd split kind of fits all together in that moment very well, given that there's so much history in that moment and it being Edge's first title reign. And it just all kind of fits together in this kind of symphony and cheers and boos that was going on in the audience that night too.
Yeah, it does. And I think, again, you're seeing this dynamic repeat itself over and over, though. I mean, the whole rejection for the babyface for WWE, who just seems to have no idea how to successfully implement and create a babyface in 2019, or for that matter, the last decade. A true top guy that is ultra hot and that, you know, all walks of life, all ages, all races can get behind. It's been a challenge for WWE to recreate the Austins and Rocks. And yes, they are a once-in-a-generation performer, and we understand that. But some of the booking mistakes and presentation of the way that they they create these characters is really on the booking team, not so much the guys that they're selecting at times. And yes, this was a crossroads in John Cena's career, and I think a lot of it was the backlash of coming off the Attitude Era, where Austin's no longer active, Rock's no longer active. It's, you know, it's not the same cast of characters anymore. The landscape's changing. Brock Lesnar's gone. He's off doing, I don't even know if he was doing football at the time. I think at that point he was done with football in 06. But at this point, again, it's a transition period, and you have these new guys coming up. And you have John Cena at the helm and the crowd rejecting the way that WWE was presenting him, at least in Albany we did anyway, so maybe we're the a-holes. I don't know. But we were not happy with John Cena. We were happy to see him lose. And it kind of reminded me, as you were talking about Edge earlier in the night defeating, or rather Ric Flair defeating Edge by disqualification, was the same kind of thing, in a way, of Randy Orton at Randy Orton versus Seth Rollins at WrestleMania 31, when Seth Rollins lost to Randy Orton in the awesome finish that they turned to Stomp into an RKO, which was still an amazing spot, and then having Seth come back out at the end of the night to cash in on Brock and Roman Reigns to really save that main event from the audience losing their minds, booing it out of the building, had Roman Reigns won, even though I think the match was good. So that kind of sparked my memory in parallel to that. But as far as the rest of the card goes, I mean, there were some notable things here. I mean, we have Triple H defeating Big Show. I mean, I don't know how interesting that was at the time. Chavo Guerrero defeated Snitsky. If you remember Snitsky, Mr. It Wasn't My Fault, which imagine running that storyline in 2019 about an abortion. My God. I mean, just thinking.
Oh, remember his foot fetish, too, as well?
That's right. I mean, just to think of some of the things that WWE has done, and they are trying to scrub that from the minds of fans and their charitable good doings and all the stuff they do now. Man, they are running and running far and away from what their identity used to be. But so, yeah, I mean, that was probably the biggest moment of the night, without question. John Cena winning and then Edge cashing in. Anything else that you wanted to note on this?
You know, one of the things that really caught my eye, you know, when you're saying about this transitional era, one of the things that really stuck out to me was you had the Trish Stratus versus Mickey James match for the WWE Women's Championship, which that went on for 7 minutes and 18 seconds. And there was that weird, you know, lesbian fandom relationship storyline going on between the two. But at least the two of them both could wrestle, and they both had, you know, they both were kind of progressing the women's division along. And so it was nice to see that on the card, and they both were working a pretty decent match together. So that was a nice little moment there, and seeing that kind of be a moment where you could sort of see the women's revolution kind of taking form, even though they were doing what they could with what they were given. But then you look further down the card, and you have the bra and panties gauntlet right. match that went on for 11 minutes and one yeah. second. So a full 4 minutes given to it, and it kind of shows you that weird transitional period that wrestling was having at that time, too, where they didn't really know what they wanted to do. They were still trying to be trashy, but they didn't really know, you know, what direction to be trashy. They were just doing it for the sake of shock value. That's why you ended up having that really high rating with the Edge and Lita sex thing not too long after this. So it was a weird time for wrestling, and you know, not long after that you had the 2010 era, which, you know, probably was one of the biggest drop-offs in viewership. So it definitely was a big, you know, boom or bust time, and I think they definitely probably did more of the bust not too long after that. So there was some definite good that came out of this era, but it was definitely a weird transitional period for wrestling, for sure.
It was. It's just the no man's land, you know, WWE's trying to find their foothold again. You know, they don't have any true competition. They are really the only kings in the kingdom, and they were trying to find themselves again, I think. And like you said, here we have Trish and Mickie James. Had it not been for them and a few others like Lita to legitimize the women's division, they still would have just been sexified. Unfortunately, after this year, the Divas Championship was introduced pretty shortly after, and it was just something that I think degraded the female division even further until we got the women's belt back. So again, you're talking about coming full circle. There's another example of, there's the women's championship, but we have a bra and panties match, and don't worry, the Divas Championship is now going to be a thing, and then that goes away, only to have the biggest women's revolution in wrestling history occur less than a decade later. So it's just funny how things go. But so beyond those pay-per-views, there are a few moments that I have to bring up. I mean, you just can't go without this, and I can't believe, and it saddens me to my soul to say, that I was not in attendance for this. I don't know what the hell came over me to not attend this Monday Night Raw, the Raw before WrestleMania 15, of which Austin came in with the beer truck, and in the biggest moment in Raw history, as voted on by the fans, which I believe WWE announced, I think it was Raw 20, the 20th anniversary of Raw, or Raw 1000, or something like that, in which they voted to say this was the biggest moment in Raw history. Austin comes out. We all know the routine. He showers the corporation in beer, cuts a promo on the top of the beer truck. And then later in the night, people forget this, but later in the night, he actually faced Paul White, not known as the Big Show yet, and ended up defeating Paul White after a few chair shots and a stunner. And then immediately after, Paul White, pops back up, and him and Mankind, which was the referee at the time, ended up brawling as they brawled, and Austin was celebrating. So what were your memories of this? I would assume you were in attendance for this.
This one I wasn't. I was still pretty young at the time. This would have been, let's see, March 22nd, so I would have just been 4 years old at the time. Yep, so still a little young. I was actually just picking up wrestling, believe it or not, though. I was beginning to watch Raw probably, I would say, a year before this. I would say probably 3.5 years old is when I started watching Raw on a weekly basis in, like, 98. So this probably would have been one of the episodes that I would have watched. So I do definitely have it in my memory banks, and definitely have watched the clip thousands of times since then as a wrestling fan. And, just the flopping around in the ring, and The Rock selling the beer as if it's a wrestling move. And it just so much craziness going on with the actual music hitting and him coming down with the truck. And it's just such an awesome moment. And, Austin just always delivers in ways that you never expect.
And you mentioned the selling of the beer. I mean, all I can think of is Austin spraying Vince, and Vince is like trying to swim to get out of the ring. It is just the visual of that is burned in my memory. It is hilarious to watch. And seeing that happen was just I still laugh, even though I've seen it, like you said, a thousand times. But seeing Vince McMahon trying to swim to get out of the ring is the thing I won't forget. And actually, Austin said that he pulled a rib on himself. I think it was in his VHS. Yes, I said VHS of Hell Yeah was the name of the VHS. And he said he pulled a rib on himself by trying to give himself a drink with the hose. And he said if he had tonsils, he would have washed them right down his throat because of the pressure of the beer, which was real beer, by the way. Trying to give himself a drink with that hose was like trying to give yourself a drink with a fire hose because, I mean, you can't. It's just coming out too fast. So he said he pulled a rib on himself doing that. A moment I'll never forget, and one that I am so – I really hope it was something massive going on in my life at that time to not attend this Monday Night Raw, or I just took that the glory days of wrestling for granted. Again, I was at 98. I was 13 years old. I had no reason not to go to this. Damn it, what is wrong with me?
It's funny. I actually have personally signed a petition to get a banner put in Times Union Center commemorating the exact date that this Austin beer truck moment happened. That's how much I am committed to this moment being a part of Albany history, damn it.
It's true, though. I mean, how can you I mean, how can they not be proud of this being the location of the highest rated or the most beloved segment of Monday Night Raw history? I know, all joking aside, that really should be something that they have somewhere. I mean, even if it's not, you know, front and center on the, you know, the Times Union logo, but it's a massive moment. It was a magical moment. It was a moment you can't duplicate, and WWE certainly tried a number of times before with Austin coming back and doing it to Santino after making fun of the movie that Austin was in, and they did it with the milk truck with Kurt Angle, but it wasn't the same. It still wasn't the same. Anytime they try to recreate, which WWE loves to do, it never quite worked. And but this moment was, I mean, listen to the reaction. If you haven't seen this and you're a wrestling fan, I don't know how you haven't seen this. You need to see this. So anyway, those are my thoughts on the beer truck. The other moment, still relating to Stone Cold, you guys see a theme here, but Austin had some massive moments here. Back in 2002, when Stone Cold was, the WWE conducted a draft, and Austin still was not signed they didn't conduct a draft. Austin was coming off of a newly returned babyface, and Austin was either going to sign with Raw or he was going to sign with SmackDown. And at the time, Austin, and keep in mind, the date here is April 1st, 2002. I was personally in attendance for this. And he ended up shaking hands with Vince, who was the face of SmackDown at the time, at least trying to get Austin to come to SmackDown. Shook hands with Vince and, apologized to Ric Flair and said, business is business. And then he told Vince, hey, there's one more thing about this contract and tonight. And he said April Fools, and ends up giving Vince McMahon a stunner, ends up actually stunning Ric Flair after he, you know, had chugged some beer with him. And so it was an awesome moment all around. Again, not huge significant in the history of WWE annals of time, but at least in my memory, in Matt's memory, it was a huge moment. And especially looking back now, you just take those days and those shows for granted. But I love that segment anyway.
Yeah, you know, it's crazy to think just how much of Steve Austin really is ingrained in Times Union Center and Pepsi Arena, and just the history that he has with the building and returning to it for, you know, his return against Rikishi at No Mercy, and, you know, having, you know, getting hauled off in the cops with the in the back of Times Union Center and all of that. You know, it's just there's so much of his career that all is represented here in Albany. It's just such a cool part of wrestling history, and having him kind of be this local guy, considering that he's the Texas Rattlesnake, you know, having him kind of be wrapped up in so much history here in Albany is such a cool thing. And, you know, all the moments that he's had in the wrestling ring, and every little moment that he has built his character and built his lore. And I love the fact that he's one of the few wrestlers who has left out on top. And you know, so many people call for him to get back in the ring one more time. And as much as there's a part of my brain that itches at that, you know, just ever so much, you know, I'm glad that he left it where he is. And he just leaves this badass lasting image in your mind. And every time you see him, you're like, oh, I wonder if he's just going to pop out a stunner on somebody at any given moment.
Which is all he needs to do at this point. And I would love to see him return again, but would I really love it? We've seen legends return, and it just doesn't go well because they can't be who they were. And Father Time gets everybody, and injuries get everybody. So would I like to see Austin in one last match? I guess I would, but I'd be very cautious because I don't want to taint the memory of what Austin was. So, I mean, actually, another fun fact before we wrap things up here is some of you may know this, some of you may not, where Edge got his name was actually because of Albany, New York. There was a radio station at the time called The Edge, 105-something, I think it was, and he was listening to the local radio station, and he was like, hey, that's a damn cool name, and that's where he got the name Edge, was from one of our radio stations, so how about that?
Oh, that's really interesting. That's not something that I realized. So that's kind of another full circle reason as to why he ended up winning WWE gold here too, I guess, right? It all kind of makes sense and links together. Somehow the crazy mind of Vince McMahon works magic sometimes, doesn't it?
It does. I'm sure it's totally on purpose. Yeah,
exactly.
So is there anything else I missed? I mean, I know we could go match by match here in terms of the card, but what were any other moments that maybe you wanted to bring up that we haven't discussed?
One thing that sticks out in my mind, speaking of moments of that we've been to live, I went this year to the May 20th episode of Raw, which was when Mick Foley revealed the 24/7 title, which is pretty awesome considering that there is actually a lot of history with the hardcore title in Albany as well. There's been quite a lot of title changes throughout the year. Actually, on that April 1st episode of Raw that you were talking about with Austin, Bubba Ray defeated Raven for the hardcore title. There have been a couple of different hardcore title changes throughout the years here in Albany, too. I think maybe one or two other examples, but having Mick Foley kind of reveal the 24/7 title was a nice little moment. The reaction to Brock winning the Money in the Bank was a big sticking point in my mind. I was kind of walking into the building a little bit pissed off after the whole fiasco with him grabbing the Money in the Bank and winning it that way, and seeing Titus O'Neil become the first champion, and then Robert Roode pinning, and it just was cool to see the footage of the back of the Times Union Center being used too, with R-Truth winning with the pin over. I think he put him in the trunk and like jumped on top and pinned him that way, but it was like the backdrop where you saw Rikishi and the No Mercy moment and everything. So it was like seeing that 19 years later and seeing the 24/7 title and you know, the Greenwich street fight in Albany that happened, and just all the different things that have happened in that same back parking lot where they charge you $30 to park your car before the show happens. You know, like it's just so awesome to see all of that happen and come together. And that was just a cool moment to happen, you know, 19 years later, and see it on the pay-per-view footage. And so the 24/7 title moment was a pretty cool video package that'll stick out in modern times as something that, you know, is very representative of wrestling in Albany. So that was a cool little moment that I got to see live.
That is, yeah, and I wasn't able to attend that, so that's cool you bring that up. And I do remember seeing that backdrop of Austin, and I could almost see the silhouette of Rikishi laying against the, I remember it was like a rocky background or something, like it was like laying on the ground, but it was, there was like rocks or something, and I remember I could just almost see Austin's truck there, and I could see Rikishi bloody just kind of slouch there, and I remember so that's funny you bring that up. And another moment I remember that already, I forgot too, was when Shawn Michaels was the commissioner of Monday Night Raw, and Vince fired Shawn Michaels, and at the end of Raw, Shawn ended up giving Sweet Chin Music to Vince McMahon. And so I remember that very clearly as well, before, you know, he went completely away and then found God and did his own thing and came back in 2002 and faced Triple H and at SummerSlam. So, just so many moments I'm like racking through my brain. It's crazy. So, this has been a pretty good fun trip down memory lane. And hopefully those of you that have no idea about the Times Union Center or Knickerbocker Arena / Pepsi Arena, now know that there was some damn significant things that happened here, even in good old Smallbony.
Absolutely, yeah. And you know, so many title changes and so many different things throughout the year. And it goes to show you, you know, if WWE comes around here, especially if they do come back for another pay-per-view, don't be an idiot like I was when I was a wrestling fan younger. Buy a damn ticket, because you're going to regret it and you're going to miss out on probably a title change and probably something very significant in history, because there always seems to be a crazy moment going on that they want to make happen here in Albany. So it's cool that they bring a lot of action to upstate New York, and it's cool to look back on all the crazy history that's happened here.
Yeah, it's very, very true. I mean, yeah, if you ever get a chance to go to a pay-per-view, grab it. Again, there hasn't been a pay-per-view here in 13 years, now almost 14. So, yes, pay-per-views are few and far between. Live events are few and far between. Televised are even fewer. And then pay-per-views are just a rarity. So, yes, pay-per-views, if you don't go, you're really cheating yourself out of a great time. And that is sincere. I mean, just all the memories I can have. And now the product is starting to revive itself. And yes, we have a little bit of competition with AEW, but the product itself, even WWE by itself, has some talent. Of course, the booking is always questionable, but the talent is there. So, anyway, Zach, this has been a blast. And of course, don't forget, everybody, check out the AEW Aftershock show that Zach does every single Thursday. Drops on Thursday for the AEW Dynamite show on Wednesday. So before you go, though, let everyone know about any social media you may have or anything else.
Absolutely. So, like I said, like you said, rather, every Thursday I drop the review for AEW Dynamite, the AEW Aftershock. You can follow me at Spots High on Twitter. I'm always dropping all sorts of opinions, articles, all sorts of different things. So always be sure to look out for everything new. Always, live tweeting, if I'm still keeping up with Raw or SmackDown, depending on what my opinion of the product is on any given week. But always making sure to give you my review of Dynamite every week on Thursday. So follow me at Spots High on Twitter and keep an eye out for new projects coming soon too.
Absolutely. Yes. And we'll talk more about that as things evolve, but Zach, thanks so much for being on the show and we'll look forward to your Thursday show about AEW. And of course, coming back on here sometime in the near future.
Absolutely. Sounds good. Always a blast talking with you. Had a good time tonight.
Definitely. Take care, Zach.
You too.